Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Hi, it's the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Casey Siler, state editor and Capital Bureau chief for the Albany Times Union. Casey is also one of the hosts of Public Television's New York Now, a statewide political program. Welcome back, Casey.
Alan, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, of all the things you do, is that the New York Now, you go out on the street and people say to you, hey, Casey, I know you from television, don't they?
I do get recognized in restaurants more often than one would if one was merely a print reporter. I don't mean to say merely a print reporter,
because that's my dominant gig.
Right, yes, right. Exactly. Yeah, it's something, the power of television to make you recognizable, including people who like kind of can't place you, but they're kind of like,
are you famous?
Who are you again?
Are you famous? Are you someone?
Yes.
So I want you to know that I did TV for way over 30 years and on the commercial stations around here. And I would go out and people would run up to me and they would say, hey, I watch you on television, aren't you the weatherman or whatever they say, you know, in television. But I would go to a cocktail party in the Berkshires and everybody would talk about WAMC.
Oh, sure.
And I would say, do you watch me on TV? And they say, you're on TV?
What's amazing is how much kind of throw New York Now has. Like my mother is from Ontario,
right,
and so some of her relatives who live in Toronto or live in Bracebridge will like see it, and they'll be like, yeah, we're watching on the television last week.
Right. Well, enough of that. Casey, let's talk about the fact that we have just heard, as we sit here, that Kirsten Gillibrand says Cuomo would be a great candidate for the Democrats to run against Trump in 2020. What is that about?
You know, at least home state candidate for Kirsten Gillibrand. I mean, well, you know, what else is she going to say? She, of course, is going to support a New York Democrat. Even the prospect of him running, also, it sort of deflects a little bit of attention from people who say that she ought to consider running in 2020, which, you know, she is kind of shunted aside and, you know, is very much used kind of Cuomo's playbook for questions like that, which is to answer and say, look, I'm very focused on the job I have right now.
What else would you say? You only say, I'll do it when they ask you. If you don't get asked at a prom, you're not saying, you know.
Yeah. I mean, what is the percentage in Kirsten Gillibrand saying, no, I don't think Andrew Cuomo would make a good potential candidate? That's not a good Democratic thing to do in any way, shape or form.
You certainly don't want that guy on, you know, being tough on you, do you?
Well, Kirsten Gillibrand is sort of, she's kind of, I shouldn't say above. Her realm is considerably different from Cuomo's realm in so many ways. I mean, she's concerned with federal issues. Certainly, there's a lot of overlap there, including on issues that, you know, I'm sure we're going to go on to talk about, such as what the repeal of the Affordable Care Act might mean for New York.
Sure.
Legislation that would have federal applications but would have, you know, special import for the Empire State. I mean, they're definitely going to be on the same page on those issues. But in the Venn diagram of things that they care about, there's a lot more federal things that Kirsten Gillibrand cares about.
Well, but you know, Casey Siler, there have been some who have said over the years that Andrew's attitude is, if you're not me, you're no good. And he does get into fights with almost everybody. Attorney General Schneiderman, with Tom DiNapoli, the comptroller of the state of New York, and others. And, you know, it seems to me it's pretty good to stay on his safe side, because otherwise, sooner or later, since the guy doesn't play well in the sandbox, it'll come around to you.
Well, he is definitely a sharp-elbowed advocate for a strong executive. That's certainly one way to put it. What's interesting now is that you're increasingly seeing kind of pushback against that, as Cuomo has been somewhat weakened by, you know, the federal and state investigations into upstate development projects that really kind of swamped him last year and, you know, poses potential pitfalls for him in the months ahead as at least the federal case heads toward trial. You're seeing pushback, especially on his proposals that would expand his purview, such as his proposal to create an executive branch chief procurement officer who, you know, just based on what the proposal looks like, would sort of be a second floor. We refer to the executive branch as the second floor of the Capitol because that's where the governor's offices are primarily located. A second floor controller, as it were, who would, you know, be independent, but would definitely operate under the umbrella of the governor.
Let me stop you there, because I think people may have forgotten what's afoot. The governor, along with the legislature, who inexplicably went along with this, took away from Tom DiNapoli, the comptroller, some very important powers. There are many people who thought that Cuomo's pals, who are now facing the bar of justice, would not have been there had DiNapoli been allowed to go ahead and do the kinds of audits that he used to be authorized to, which he can't anymore. And so now the chutzpah factor, as we say, is that instead of giving those powers back to DiNapoli so he can do those audits, they now turn around and make it go the other way, which is to say, as you've just said, I'll appoint my own watchdogs. Ridiculous. That's the fox guarding the henhouse.
Well, it's decidedly speculative to say that if the controller had the kind of enhanced powers that, you know, Joe Prococo and Todd Howe and Alain Calieros, who are the main figures in the federal investigation, would not have faced these charges or got into the shenanigans that they're alleged to have gotten into. Although in the case of Todd Howe, who has admitted to being a lobbyist bagman, you know, it's slightly different. And there is significant dispute between the governor and SUNY and the controller as to exactly what the scope of the powers that were taken away from the controller, you know, what the impact of those would have been. But there is absolutely no doubt that the controller and the attorney general, Tom DiNapoli and Eric Schneiderman, are both pushing back against the expansion of executive power and the corresponding or complementary, I guess one would say, potential diminishment of their oversight powers. Schneiderman has sent forceful letters both on the executive branch procurement officer that we were talking about and also more recently on the expansion of the civil litigation powers of Cuomo's Department of Financial Services, which sort of covers the banking and insurance industry.
Let's talk Casey Seiler, the crack reporter for the Albany Times Union. Let's talk for a moment about Schneiderman. Now, Schneiderman, as we've joked around on this program before, is Attorney General, AG, otherwise known as almost governor.
Aspirant governor, I think, is what they say.
Aspirant governor. I like almost. Yeah. Okay, so now he's looking to get ahead, as all politicians do, and he's being very, very tough on Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
The governor has a little bit of a bigger problem because the governor, if he goes too hard on Trump, risks Trump getting back at New York State, and he has a budget that he has to defend, and that could be disaster. So Schneiderman seems to be in the ascendancy in his criticism of Trump and makes him popular.
Yeah, Schneiderman has without a doubt been more pointed in his criticism specifically of Trump. He, of course, has a long history with Donald Trump long before he apparently even contemplated running for president. Schneiderman brought civil suit against Trump University, which, of course, is a case that President-elect Trump settled. I think it was in, late November, early December, for more than $20 million, if memory serves. And Schneiderman has been calling Trump out by name in press releases. He ripped the nomination of Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. He went after Scott Pruitt, who's going to be the new head of the EPA. Just in the last 2 days, he has released, you know, scathing statements on the sort of redone immigration directive and the sort of policy memorandum that goes along with it, or the expected second immigration executive order, I should say, as well as the decision to pull back sort of federal protection for transgender teenagers in high school, the sort of bathroom issue.
So I want to move on from there to the idea of what should go on at congressional town meetings. Now, Casey Seiler, I have gotten more mail on this than any other single thing I've ever seen, because people like John Faso, Elise Stefanik, and many others have said that since groups of people have been coming in and not letting the congressman talk or speak, that they're not going to face that. They're not going to face hell. Now, your paper has opined against that, said people have a right to confront their legislators, and they should do that. Stefanik and Faso should do that, among others. So what is your take on all of this?
Well, I wrote a story about this last week in the Times Union, and it's fascinating because what you're seeing is a complete flipping of the script from 2009 and 2010, when, of course, Democrats, especially in the run-up to passage of the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, faced these raucous, you know, seething town halls. It was really sort of the beginning, the first bloom, as it were, of the Tea Party movement. Excuse me, where, for example, Paul Tonko, who is, you know, the Amsterdam Democrat who represents the bulk of the capital region, you know, would get hundreds, almost 2,000 people at some of these events, and heated, to say the least, in so many ways.
But he took it.
He did. He took it because he believes, he told me that, you know, we're this job is not about being in a safe space, you know, a comfortable zone, that you're there. And he said an interesting thing. He said it's not just about being there for the Congress, for the member of Congress to hear from his or her constituents. It is also about creating an arena wherein people who are hotly opposed on any given issue can come together and hear what the other side has to say. The idea that the Congress member is both there to listen and to kind of serve as something of a referee or a facilitator for this kind of community discourse. Now, Tonko on Monday night held a town hall meeting, his latest town hall meeting, out in Schenectady. And it was, of course, a very different scene because it was people coming in with, it was a packed house, according to Matthew Hamilton, my colleague who was there covering it. Packed house, a lot of support for Tonko, a lot of questions about what Tonko knew, which in many cases was not much, about where the Republican-led Congress and President Trump was going to go on the repeal, revision, remaking of the Affordable Care Act. You know,
as well
pick
as
one.
The environmental stuff, because Tonko is generally regarded as Mr. Environment.
Yeah, exactly. And in contrast to that, you have Elise Stefanik, just beginning her second term in the North Country, and you have John Faso, who is, of course, a longtime state lawmaker, but a freshman in the Congress, both saying that these protests just make it very hard to actually interact with constituents. So, you know, we're going to be meeting, but we're going to be meeting in small groups. And so what that means is, you know, a lot of Chamber of Commerce type events where admission is quite a bit more controlled. A lot of kind of private meetings with sort of interest specific groups. John Faso has said that he's meeting with hospital administrators, for example, but they are in general avoiding large town halls. What John Faso told me is that he's never been a fan of the town hall format, that it tends to bring out a lot of yelling and screaming and cast more heat than light. And, you know, if you look at a lot of the footage from the town hall meetings around the country, there is certainly something to be said for that. But a lot of Republican lawmakers are having these events, and they are kind of letting their constituents and, you know, progressive groups, as well as, you know, just grassroots folks, kind of have at them. And whether that is just providing sound bites and viral video clips, or it's actually educating folks, is, you know, a debate that we're having right now. On Wednesday night, I went to a protest outside the Fort Orange Club, where Faso was having a fundraiser, you know, exclusive club in downtown Albany, just about a block from the state capitol, and there were probably about 100 people there. And you know, they were holding up kind of Where's Waldo style images of Faso, and there's a lot of energy there, without a doubt. You know, and of course President Trump and other people have said, well, these are all astroturfed protests that have been ginned up by, you know, George Soros funded organizations and stuff like that. And I can say, based on you know, based on what I saw last night, it was a lot of just folks. Without a doubt, there were unions. The 1199 Healthcare Workers Union was there and had tried to get people to come out. Citizen Action, which is a progressive union affiliated activist group, was there as well. They were handing out signs and a couple of plastic buckets to use as drums, but it was a lot of people who were just meeting up on social media and coming out for it. So that's what they're up against.
You were, Casey Seiler, you were talking before about some of the Governor Cuomo's political hyphen legal problems that he faces. And now he has a trusted...
Well, not that he faces.
Well, he does face it in one way.
He faces it in the sense that he could be tarnished by what his associates have been charged with.
I would take another view of that.
Yeah.
He came in and he said he was going to clean up Albany.
Oh, yeah.
That was what he said when he got elected, and
it
helped him. He didn't clean up Albany, and now these three characters, at least three characters.
Well, eight or nine, if you include the state charges against a Capital Region developer named Joe Nicola.
Right. But I'm talking about the people who worked directly for him and with him, those three.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't look good. And so he does have to face it, and he's already said he may have to, in fact, testify at that trial. I believe you reported on that.
Yep.
So now we're going to see this thing happen, and now he has appointed Governor Cuomo, a man who I've always liked, Bob Megna, who will lead two SUNY Poly non-for-profits. What are those not-for-profits?
It's Fuller Road Management Corporation and Fort Schuyler Management Corporation. Fuller Road, and these are non-profits. Like, they are not state agencies. They are affiliated with SUNY Polytechnic, but they're basically set up for tax purposes to develop and own property. Fuller Road, by and large, owns and develops and manages the properties on the SUNY Polytechnic main campus in Albany, west of downtown. Fort Schuyler, the other one, was set up to manage and develop a lot of the developments that the governor has tried to string as, like a string of pearls, upstate SUNY Poly developments all across upstate in Utica, Rochester, Syracuse, and Buffalo is part of the Buffalo Billion, the huge solar panel manufacturing plant known as Riverbend.
So where does the money come from for these not-for-profits to buy all this land and everything else that they need?
You and me.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars in, state grants and funds have flowed through these SUNY Poly nonprofits. And of course, in the past, good government groups have raised a big hue and cry about the fact that, hey, these are nonprofits. They are not strictly required to adhere to things like open meetings law or FOIL. Now, of course, since the recent unpleasantness, both of them have adopted open meetings law. So you mentioned that Bob Megna, the former budget director, had been was named as president of both of these nonprofits. As Jimmy Vielkind of Politico New York reported, there was initially a plan to try and merge them together. But of course, there are all kinds of legal reasons why that's really complex. So Megna will now operate as president of both of those nonprofits. And that was done in a meeting that was, webcast, open to reporters and photographers and what have you, that was held on Wednesday. And
now, Megna's a popular guy, right? I mean,
he's a very smart guy. I mean, when he was budget director for Governor David Paterson during, the 2008, 2009, 2010 aftermath of the Wall Street meltdown, that's no trick. That's hazardous duty, without a doubt. And then stayed on to serve as Cuomo's budget director as well. And more recently, he has taken on sort of almost a fixer or a fireman role for Cuomo. He was, I believe, executive director of the Thruway Authority for a while. He worked on the state-controlled board that attempted to remake the New York Racing Association, that type of thing. So,
So Cuomo appoints this guy to take over.
Well, no. The nonprofits voted
him.
Yeah. Now,
But I would stand.
Yeah,
I stand
yeah.
corrected
yes,
technically,
yes.
but not really.
Not really. Yes. That it might be a bit of a distinction without a difference. You're right, because these nonprofit boards, while ostensibly they are not state controlled, they have essentially in the wake of the federal charges and the state charges, they basically handed themselves over to the state and adopted bylaws that give an increased role for the Empire State Development Corporation, the state's development agency, which, of course, Cuomo controls pretty much utterly.
But let's just take a step back here and cross the T, dot the I. The guys who are on trial now, they were involved with these groups somehow, right?
The developments that the SUNY Pali nonprofits oversaw are in many cases at the center of the federal and state charges. For example, Alain Calieros was the head of SUNY Pali.
Indeed.
He also played a significant role on the nonprofits. He, in the sort of latter years before his arrest in September, arrests, I should say, plural, in September, he had sort of removed himself from both of those nonprofit boards, but he still swung a lot of weight over there, without a doubt. Todd Howe, the aforementioned lobbyist and now admitted bagman, was a consultant to SUNY Pali, and also, of course, did work for the nonprofits as well. And he was accused of basically serving as a go-between with some of the developers who were charged, and Joe Prococo, who was the former Cuomo's former executive deputy secretary,
an alleged third son of Mario Cuomo, who was when Cuomo was eulogized. There was...
The governor described him as being essentially his father's third son. Prococo was the campaign manager for Cuomo, longtime associate, and of course the history between Cuomo, Howe, and Prococo go all the way back, you know, 30 years to his father's administration.
Casey Siler, I only got 2 minutes,
sure.
But I want to ask you real quickly. A lot of New Yorkers want ethics reform of one kind or another. There are many pushes for this to happen in the legislature. You'd have to really be sort of dumb to think the legislature is going to cut their own hands off doing this. So there's a big debate as to whether we should have a constitutional convention.
Yeah.
I've always assumed that the guys who run the legislature will run the Constitutional Convention, but apparently they're not very happy. The two leaders, Flanagan in the Senate and Boss Hastie in the Assembly, are not very happy with this, and they're calling against a Constitutional Convention. That must mean they're worried about a putsch happening in that place.
Yeah, just as any diminishment of executive power or expansion of somebody else's power is seen as a diminishment of Cuomo's power, the potential to take the operation of the gears and levers of lawmaking or constitution amending out of the hands of lawmakers and the governor is not getting a popular reception. The governor at the beginning of 2016 said, you know what, a constitutional convention could be a real democratic reboot. Yeah. And he proposed, I think it was $1 million for sort of a preliminary committee to kind of lay the groundwork and say, here's what a convention could deal with. You know, that's pin money in the state budget. The governor kind of bargained it away in last year's budget negotiation. And since then, he's always said, yeah, we're still looking at that. We're looking at seeing how we can do it. But he's remained completely radio silent. And now, of course, you have both legislative leaders coming out against it. You've also got unions coming out against it. You've got some, but not all, environmental groups coming out and saying, oh, this could be the end of, you know, Forever Wild in the Adirondacks and stuff like that. In other words, people are saying, look what happened in 2016. Everybody said, oh, no, that could never happen, kind of sweeping unexpected political outcome. And now they're using that to argue against the state constitutional convention.
Yes, and so when I saw Speaker Hastie, who I call Boss Hastie, or John Flanagan, the head of the Senate, coming out against it, I scratched my head and said, I've been against it all along. Maybe I'm wrong. In any case, we're out of time. Our guest has been Casey Siler, state editor and Capitol Bureau chief for the Albany Times Union. Casey, as always, you're terrific. Thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Lively conversation.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.